On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
I'm joined in the studio now by Sinead O'Carroll, who's the editor of thejournal.ie, and by Fergus Finlay, who's a columnist with the Irish Examiner, a former chief executive of Barnardo's, now a member of the board of directors of the HSE. Thank you both for coming in, and good morning. I feel very aware that I have to thank you for both for coming in, because I don't know for how much longer we'll be able to keep getting guests in studio. So I'm just going to appreciate this kind of fluidity while we have an opportunity. Fergus, talk to yourself first, because you have a little bit of experience in the machinery of government buildings as a former chef de cabinet for the Labour Party. Obviously, these aren't decisions that anyone wants to rush into. But at the same time, when we know since Friday morning that NPHET have been calling for a level five, you can understand why people are really, really hesitant to allow this to go on any longer, that they just want a bit of conclusivity, irrespective of whether it's good news or bad.
Well, no, it can't go on longer. And in fact, to be honest with you, I watched the 9 o'clock news last night. I thought there was a complete absence of leadership shown last night. If they can't come and tell us what the decision is, they must come and tell us what the process is. I mean, I would have expected the Taoiseach to come out last night and say, look, we had a long meeting today. We discussed this, this and this. There are some very complex decisions to be made here. There's a fine balance to be struck. Cabinet subcommittee has met all day. Cabinet is meeting tomorrow.
And there was a statement to that effect last night, at least, wasn't there?
The what?
There was a press release.
There was a statement. There was a statement, and there was a doorstop with Eamon Ryan, which I couldn't make head or tail of. I thought it needed an awful lot more clarity. I thought, like, we need a sense of firm thinking, thoughtful people at the helm. At the moment, what we're getting is a sense that Fine Gael backbenchers think one thing, Fine Gael backbenchers think another thing, that they're scoring points off each other, etc., etc., etc. And that needs to be stopped. That needs to be. If we can't, for a day or two, get clarity about the decisions, and I think I know what the decisions need to be. But then I'm just a citizen like everybody else. Everyone's view is the same value as everyone else's. Mm-hmm. That we have to have some clarity about the process. I mean, as of now, I couldn't tell you, Gavin, and I don't think you could tell you exactly when and how decisions are going to be communicated.
No, which is a very open question. And Sinead, it does make it very difficult then for people who are desperate to have some sense of certainty, and they just don't know, not alone when the decision is going to be or when it's going to be announced, but also indeed how they're even going to hear about it.
And I think you make a really good point there, Fergus, about that leadership lacking last night, because everyone knew that there was something happening. You know, there was pictures of, you know, the waiting media outside government buildings, but no clarity of when that something will be announced. And I was getting a lot of texts just from friends and family saying, hey, do you know what's going on? As if I have insider knowledge because of our roles. And like you said, there was a statement, so you can send back, this is a statement, but there's no face to that. There's no, you know, appearance on the 9 o'clock news or kind of the approach that people will expect when they have these kind of announcements.
When the media approach a fella in a high-vis jacket wearing a bicycle helmet, and a few seconds later, you suddenly realise, oh, that's Eamon Ryan. He's the leader of the Green Party.
Thank you for clarifying, because I was going to have to clarify even what you were talking about. The guy in the high-vis jacket is not just some sort of a vox pop. It's the Minister for Transport.
But, you know, you're sitting there, you're waiting. The whole country is anxious. You know, we need to know what the hell is going on and what our immediate future is like. One of the things you task us with on a Sunday morning is reading all the Sunday newspapers, and the amount of emotive language that's in the Sunday papers on both sides of this debate. And it's all absent facts, that's not a healthy position to be in.
Because there's only the half dozen people inside the room who actually have the full information at their fingertips from your Houlihans and your Glynns and your Nolans and all of your business representatives and everyone else.
Yeah, because what happened yesterday actually is quite normal. You know, there's lots of advisory groups that cabinet ministers will meet on a daily basis. But the fact that, you know, they were being followed by cameras and journalists, kind of putting a kind of celebrity side to the idea of advisors going in to advise politicians and politicians then to sit around and make a decision. So actually all of that was quite a normal behaviour yesterday, but it's now that there's an absence of that last step from, from the political leaders. That's
the problem. But even the language around that, I mean, the first thing I heard on the radio yesterday was that Tony Holohan, Ronan Glynn and Philip Nolan had been summoned to government buildings. Now, you get summoned to government
buildings.
They're
there most days of the week, it should be said. They're there most days of the week, and people were going, oh, what's Tony Holohan going into government buildings for?
He's in there almost every week.
I mean, if the language had been, you know, they're going in to brief the cabinet, and there's going to be a debate and a discussion, that'd be one thing. But you summon ambassadors from foreign powers to put them on the carpet and to berate them. My immediate reaction to it, I've been around the block a few times, my immediate reaction to the language of being summoned to government buildings was, somebody's going to get a kick in here. Mm. And that's not helpful. It's just not helpful.
Do you understand, Sinead, why the government at least needs to take its time over a decision like this? That although everyone is on tenterhooks and everyone really wants to know exactly what the future is going to look like and try and have some certainty about the next 4 or 6 weeks or Christmas or what's going to come after this stage of lockdown, that it isn't the sort of thing that you can rush into. It's not the sort of decision that you want to be convening ministers into government buildings at the dead of night on a Saturday for, that it's the sort of thing that they might be better sleeping on and weighing up all the consequences of and fleshing out before they announce something.
Just tell us they're doing that.
Yeah, I understood it last week more, and I understood, even though there was a lot of furore over Leo Varadkar's comments on Claire Byrne, I kind of understood that position more, that there were certain things that needed to be put in place. And we saw some of those things then in the budget.
And they were taken aback by it all and all
that.
But
there was some things like the business rebates of up to 5,000 a week. All of those things had to be put in. I could understand that position more than, say, this week, when we've had this recommendation for level 5 for a few weeks.
So they had a fortnight to sit on it if they thought they were going to have to act on it.
Yeah, so the reticence to make a decision now, I think, is because it's a very, very, very difficult decision. And they're trying to buy some time, perhaps, to communicate that or to find some level 4.5 that feels a little bit
softer. And part of the context for that, though, and it's important that we not forget it. Today, there are 30 people in intensive care as a result of COVID. And they are 30 people who are really seriously ill, really seriously ill, and not all of them will make it. And they're surrounded by huge teams of highly qualified people, 24/7, helping them to fight for their lives. That's 30 people today. If it was 60 people tomorrow, if it was 90 people on December the 25th, you know, we'd have a major crisis on our hands, and we've got to turn those numbers back.
Which I thought was actually something very striking about what Eamon Ryan said last night when he was asked, was there going to be a decision tonight or tomorrow? And he said, well, the numbers currently in hospital don't warrant us having to rush into a decision overnight, that we have a couple of days to wait, perhaps not fully accounting for the fact that a decision you make now only really has an impact in a fortnight's time, because infections in the meantime have already been seeded, to use the word. By the way, Mark Acosta, Green Party TD, has been in touch to say that, hang on now, a fellow wearing a high vis and a helmet in no way either qualifies or disqualifies someone for comment. He was doorstepped as he was going home, and this business of presenting someone cycling being less competent is a narrative that
I wasn't saying that, and he ought to know that. I wasn't saying that.
No.
I was talking about the image that was presented to an anxious nation waiting. I mean, if I was Eamon Ryan, I'd have taken off my helmet and my high vis, and I'd have talked to the media, you know, the way ministers talk to the media.
To be fair, Mark might have been talking about me when I said that it could have just been some vox pop with some man on the street, and it was actually the Minister for Transport. But the point is taken anyway. There's an awful lot to get through in today's paper, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more from Fergus and Sinead in just a moment.
Obviously, it's a huge achievement, nice achievement from my family and club and all that sort of thing. And it's obviously something you look back on when your career's over. But thankful to get the opportunity tonight. It's a nice achievement.
There's Dean Rock after scoring 1-8 in Parnell Park last night as the Dublin footballers returned to their home venue for the first time in a decade. Dean Rock, in scoring 1-8, moved ahead of Jimmy Keaveney to become Dublin's all-time leading goal scorer. My producer has written in here as an extra note, what a legend. And as a Meath man watching that match, not quite as legendary. In fact, we'll always have a historical claim because of the Rock family's long-standing residency in Ashburn. But we'll let that sit for a little while. More to come on yesterday's games and today to come when we speak to Neil Tracy a little bit later. Good bit of coverage in the papers today on the fact actually that those games are going ahead, and the reports of club celebrations being the cause of a lot of the spikes in some counties. And we'll talk to Sinead and Fergus about that a little bit later. Sinead O'Carroll of the Journal.ie and Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner, still both with me in studio. Sinead, there was one piece in today's papers, particularly a piece by Maeve Sheehan in the Sunday Independent, that you wanted to have a deeper dive into.
Yeah, because she talks about the virus ensnaring communities, and she starts with a description of some of the contact tracing that happened in Offaly over the last while. And I think it points to a big flaw in some people's idea that we can move on with our lives if we're not vulnerable, and just shield and protect the vulnerable, of which there are many. But she explains that in Offaly there was contact tracing which traced an outbreak to a pub. So some young people going about their business, as proponents of this plan would expect. They were probably having a socially distant, quite safe drink in a pub, but they ended up contracting the virus. It went back to university share house, where four housemates all got it. Then one of those housemates was picked up by their parents. He went home, he or she went home, and then the sister contracted it. That sister happened to work in a nursing home. So you can see how easily that the people in nursing homes would not be shielded. Luckily, she wasn't in work the week that she contracted and was asymptomatic. So everybody in that nursing home remained safe. But would that, in this existence of a just shield the vulnerable plan, would everyone who works in a nursing home, even people like her, a young woman who's a part-time staff, would she also have to shield herself? Where would she live? If she lives with her parents right now, would she have to move out? Or would her parents then also have to shield? Would all the four university students, because they're connected to her, have to shield? Mm. It's a massive flaw in this plan that I'm not sure people who are talking about it have thought out completely.
It is an underrated point, isn't it, Fergus, this idea of the chain of dominoes, and that there are some who would rather just allow the world to go back to what it was, allow the economy to recover, to let it rip, but almost just to partition those who have some sort of underlying condition or vulnerability, to have them sequestered from society.
The only way you can shield the vulnerable is by locking them in a room and sliding food under the door. And if they get sick or pick up the flu or whatever, just ignore that. That's the only way you can shield the vulnerable from coronavirus. The argument that we can or should get on with the rest of our lives while sequestering the vulnerable is a form of eugenics, to be perfectly honest. It is. You might as well say let them die, because you cannot shield vulnerable people if you don't take care of your own behaviour. And that's at the heart of this. The Minister for Public Expenditure talked the other day about common sense. It's a bit more than common sense. It's common decency to wear a mask, to sanitize your hands, to keep your distance. And you see it all the time. You see it everywhere. There's a huge debate in the papers and on media about should GAA matches go ahead. Mm. We know the GAA matches are not the problem. It's the GAA fans that are the problem, and the rugby fans and the soccer fans, and anyone who decides the hell with that, I'm going to have a few pints and wander around the streets shouting and roaring, and the hell with anyone nearby who might be vulnerable. I had a friend who found himself caught up in a crowd, absolutely terrified because of an underlying condition, walking down the road, and suddenly this this huge crowd surrounded him, shouting and roaring because of a county final. We really do need to get a grip. I see in one of today's paper that Michael McNamara is the chair of the COVID committee.
Yeah, describes, he's got a piece in the Business Post today.
He describes a lockdown as an act of tyranny. For heaven's sake, would people in positions of authority get a grip and get some sense? Could it be an act of tyranny?
Is it not slightly more qualified than that when he says that it's an act of tyranny if it's not needed, and because he doesn't believe it's been needed anywhere else, that it shouldn't be needed here? Not respecting the fact that, of course, Ireland has a differently structured healthcare system, different demographics, different ways in which
older people live. The only reason we had a lockdown in the first place was because of every country in the OECD, Ireland has the health system which is least well able to deal with an outbreak of COVID-19. We've the highest, on the best of days, we've the highest bed occupancy rate in Irish hospitals in the OECD, not just by a little, by a multiple. And we can't and couldn't cope with an emergency. The fact that we did cope with the first emergency was, a miracle of planning and strategy and organisation and commitment at every level of the HSE. I've been a critic all my life of the HSE, and I've never been prouder of what they did during the first lockdown. But the background to it all was, if anything went wrong, we were bunched. Like, if we got beyond a point. And I'm terrified of the fact that we're not there now, but it wouldn't take much to get us there again. And whatever it takes to prevent that is what we have to do. And that's not an act of tyranny. It's an act of saving lives.
There's also a notion that Ireland is a complete outlier when you look at Europe. And that's what you're saying Michael McNamara is kind of representing there. But we've seen over the last couple of weeks that a lot of regions in Europe are catching up to the idea of what we were talking about 3 weeks ago when Tony Holohan first said that we should move to level five. A lot of it is just more regional because obviously the landmass of a lot of countries in Europe is a lot bigger. But if you look at some of the things that are happening, there are curfews, there's no indoor dining, there's no indoor pubs in a lot of regions in France at the moment.
And there's all the talk of circuit breakers in the island across the water, which of course is tantamount to, he doesn't want to call it a lockdown, so he's found some other alternative way to dress it up.
Yeah, and these political debates are happening across those countries as well. We're not as much of an outlier. We are in the fact that it's national lockdowns or level fives that we're talking about here rather than regional ones. But it's basically because Ireland is also so small that that's happening. So I think that needs to kind of be expressed a little bit more clearly. I think two of the other pieces when we're talking so much about common sense, and maybe it's a harder phrase that we need in the Sunday Independent, Brendan O'Connor is talking about an outbreak of cop-on being needed. And there's an excellent piece by Lisa Foran within who talks about the philosophy, a philosophical approach to lockdowns, and that lockdowns are more tolerable if they're of our own choosing. So we need to start looking at our own behaviours and what we can morally do, what we can choose ourselves as the morally right thing to do and the morally good thing to do and the thing that we think that we're able to cope with. And it's actually a really good piece to try and get your headspace into. How am I going to reduce my contacts this weekend? How am I going to cope with the idea of more restrictions in my life? Because I think a lot of the a lot of people's reticence to want to accept what they're living through is that they can't cope with it right now. The likes of Michael McNamara, he probably hasn't had to suffer through anything as hard as this before. So it's really, really difficult.
The approach you think is just kind of ignored and it'll go away.
Yeah, and for sometimes you can find loopholes, and a lot of time people in privileged positions can find loopholes to bad things happening in their environment. But at the moment,
such as at golf events in Clifton.
Yeah, you can't find loopholes in the data that will get you out of this pandemic. We're living through a pandemic and it's terrible.
When we talk about the reticence and the idea of wanting to just ignore things and they go away, do you think that's kind of behind why people of our age, people in their early 30s, tend to take this approach that, oh, well, I'm not going to get
you're
it.
You're in your early 30s, Kevin.
With great apologies for saying so, yeah, even though my hairline might betray otherwise. That sometimes, you know, we think of our generation or those younger than us as being bulletproof, and sure, even if we catch it, we're probably not going to be all that symptomatic, or that it'll only be a very mild dose, and sure, we'll be able to soldier on. And you know, I don't care about older people. I'm not going to be in mixing with older people, so what do I care if I get it or not? Like, how do you crack the nut on that? How do you get people to realize that there's consequences to other people beyond themselves?
Yeah, I find it difficult because I think the messaging from March and April has been clear that you can give it as easily no matter what age you are. And just because we're in our 30s doesn't mean that we're not meeting people in their 60s and 70s, or people who have asthma, or people who might have chronic heart conditions that they don't know about, or people who might just have a more extreme reaction to it than normally would. And we've seen examples of
that.
And
there is another side to this. I have to say, first of all, the most frightening thing that's happened to me today, if you're both in your early 30s, and I don't doubt it for a second, that means I'm older than the two of you put together. Though I don't feel like, you know, a vulnerable oldster. Suddenly I do, now that I've discovered how carefree we both are. I should tell the listeners that we're all surrounded by Perspex, and maybe that would occur. But here's the other side of it. My son-in-law, Tony, lost his dad recently. He didn't die of COVID. And he was his good age, a lovely, lovely man. But he died alone. You know, he couldn't be surrounded at his bedside by the people who loved him and so on. He was a man of his town. He loved his town. His town loved him. And there would have been a massive funeral. You know, you just know there would have been a massive funeral, and there wasn't. And that's part of the pain of this, that, you know, if we don't protect people, if we don't show the cop-on and the decency and all the other phrases we want to use, if we don't show that, then an awful lot of people are not just going to die. They're going to die alone. I don't want my grandkids not to be able to mourn me when I go, if I go. I don't want to go, but I, you know what I mean. I don't think anybody should find themselves in a situation where, you know, dad or mum or auntie or granny, whatever, has to be sent off on their own in the back of a hearse while you wave sadly goodbye, or you can't gather and you can't wake and you can't mourn. I mean, you know, it's one of the great Irish traditions. Somebody once said we do funerals very well, and we do.
We do.
But, you know, the wake matters, the hugs matter, and all that's now in the past because we're not managing this pandemic well enough. And it's not a lot to ask. It's just not a lot to ask.
We've had a tweet from someone who says that there's no balance on the show yet because we haven't discussed the destruction of people's lives in lockdown or the massive number of non-COVID deaths and illnesses that are caused. We will come to that in a minute because there are some pieces in today's papers about how the system is prepared and some of the consequences of COVID on those other cares. But and we'll come to that in just a second. But Sinead, there's also an editorial today, I think, in the Sunday Times about young people that you wanted to pick out about how this could be a COVID generation. And there was a similar story, I think, on the front page of the Observer today in Britain as well, about how there could be a million young people facing a jobs crisis within weeks over there. And it kind of talks about the different way in which different generations are affected by this.
Yeah, and I think that idea of there being balance again goes back to, like, a pandemic isn't the same as a reformation or a vote. It's
a revolution.
It's not the same as that. It's not the idea of balance. And like what he was saying earlier, it's not lives versus livelihoods. It's trying to find what we can do right so that we are allowing people to live, that we're not destroying the economy, but that also we're not going to have a situation that Italy had back in March and April, which I think a lot of us need to remind ourselves of, that that's the thing that we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid hundreds and or thousands of people dying from this. So it's not about, you know, that we're sitting here saying, God, I can't wait to go to level five. I'm terrified of level five. I'd love to stick in level three if we thought that we could enforce it, police it, and that that would work to bring the virus under control. It doesn't seem to be working right now. So if public health doctors are telling us it needs to change to avoid those scenarios, then we probably should listen to that. But going back to the idea then that there are some things that obviously are going to be problematic if a continued level four or level five is seen. And one of those is what hopefully won't end up being dubbed the COVID generation, but could be. In the space of the last few months, youth unemployment has reached 36.5%. That's 83,000 young people who are out of work. And there is a problem, I think, just in general in society at the moment, that we continue to infantilize people in their early 20s as if it doesn't matter if they still live with their parents.
Even
if you're
in your
early
30s, you do that.
Yeah, exactly. Or it doesn't matter if you don't earn if your job seekers isn't the same as, you know, quote unquote, real adults. You know, why are under 23 seen as different to people who are deemed as you know, more proper adults?
They still have the rent and household bills to pay.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Else.
And you know, mightn't have the parents to fall back on. But even if they do, it's you're still changing the definition of what an adult is. So I think there are things that the Sunday Times says that, you know, youth and unemployment, to make sure that we're not disaffecting young people, especially because we don't have immigration as a safety valve for employment.
I'm,
that has to be top of the list.
I'm old enough
to
have lived through a period when youth unemployment was the single greatest economic problem that this country had. There were agencies created called the Youth Employment Agency, whose sole function was to find pathways into work for young people, because it was such a pernicious problem. At least in those days, there was the possibility of young people finding work in other countries, which is simply doesn't exist now at all. I was never in favour of emigration as a safety valve, but you know, even that isn't there now. The other side of it is, and the reason this is about lives and livelihoods and about it's about all of that. It's also about services and social activity and all of that. I'm involved in a club in Bray which provides services, very crucial and important services, to adults with an intellectual disability. We have 400 members. And we have really had to struggle to try and keep those services going on a virtual basis over the last number of months. Now, we've done everything we possibly can to try and keep us. But I know the pain when day services go. I know the pain when people have to be sent home from residential services. I know the pain when people are isolated from their peers with an intellectual disability, the loneliness that's involved in all of that. And I know the difficulty of all that. And I mean, if we could get past this thing and restore some of that, it's not just the jobs. It's also the things that people do in their jobs that really make a difference to the lives of others. So, I mean, I will never make an argument that says let's put lives ahead of livelihoods, but let's find a better balance than we seem to be finding at the moment.
Which I suppose is the balance that the Cabinet itself is struggling with this weekend. I want to, I've an ad break to get through, and I do want to talk about system preparedness, and I want to leave some time for that. So we're going to take the ad break now, and we'll talk more about how exactly the health system is going to cope with an increased second wave and some of the other cases that might end up being bilateral damage, or rather some sort of passing damage.
I'll tell you something though, and it's very, lock them up, you shouldn't lock them up. Lock up the Bidens. Lock up Hillary. Lock them up.
Well, they do say that if your new material isn't landing, you should always just roll out the hits. And that's clearly what Donald Trump did at a rally last night in Georgia, going back to some of his old lines from his more popular early work. Lots of coverage of another incredible week in the presidential election race. You'll have heard a promo for it earlier, by the way, but News Talk's new podcast, Race to the White House, hosted by Simon Tierney, well worth checking out. You'll find it at newstalk.com, the News Talk app, or wherever you get your
podcasts. It's very good. It's very good.
I didn't even ask him to say that. So no, that's your sign of credibility. Fergus Findlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner, and Sinead O'Carroll of the Journal.ie, still with us in studio. Fergus, just to get it out of the way, or just as a sort of a prior acknowledgement, aside from your other many hats, you're also a member of the Board of Directors of the HSE. So I don't know if you might feel constrained in any way about a discussion on how the health system is prepared for a second wave. One hopes not. But there's an awful lot written in today's papers around how exactly the HSE is going to cope, particularly the observation made in the Sunday Times that even though the budget provide for a certain number of new beds and, you know, to be opened up next year, that we might struggle to recruit the extra nurses, which seems like a bit of a binary oversight, that the government has provided money to open beds, but not necessarily the people to staff them.
Well, it's not an oversight in the sense that the recruitment is underway, but it is a huge challenge. I mean, there shouldn't be any disputing that. The HSE, at every level of the organisation, as far as I can tell, is working as hard as it possibly can to be as ready as it possibly can. Mm. And it took advantage of, I know there's been a huge amount of talk about eye off the ball during the summer and all that kind of thing. But if, for example, we have a massive new need for PPE, we have it now. Mm. You know, investments were made, plans were made, warehouses were stocked. There is a huge amount of additional capacity. There aren't anything like the number of emergency beds and ICU beds that we'd all love to see in the country, because that simply isn't, you can't magic an ICU bed. An ICU bed requires 30 highly competent and trained staff. It requires a roster that's 24/7 and so on. So you can't just say, buy a bed and plunk it there.
So people say that the HSE lost summer because when things were fine and when we only had single digit incidence cases in June or July, and time could have been put together to try and make sure there were more ICU beds.
It went after as many ICU beds as it could get, and it has them. It went after as much testing and tracing capacity as it could build, and it had them. There was a huge problem because the early testing and tracing capacity we had, the HSE had, I shouldn't say we, was built largely on the back of staff being deployed from other jobs, HSE staff being deployed from other jobs, and seconded and so on. And they had to, at some point, be sent back to their jobs. And a plan was put in place, it didn't happen overnight, to build a permanent national testing and tracing infrastructure, and that's now being built. And you'll notice from the app, for example, and the app was one of the first apps in the world, and one that worked.
It's been used for other jurisdictions too.
We've been asked for advice from all over the world about it, and so on. You'll notice from the app that we did 100,000 tests. They did 100,000 tests. I don't want to claim credit for the HSE. I'm certainly not disavowing the HSE, I think it's the work of an extraordinary number of people who have worked around the clock. The senior management team in the HSE have taken very, very little time off, et cetera, et cetera. But at every level of the HSE, they've done everything they possibly can. But we're still not as ready as we'd love to be.
And on that, then, I want to talk to you about the story that's on the front page of the Business Post, because it tells us that the private hospitals are opposing the proposed new HSE deal because, A, as Matt Cooper points out in the back page of that paper, there's a certain amount of robbing Peter to pay Paul, but that they simply don't feel like they are getting adequate recompense for that, and that they're really concerned that if they were to hand over more private capacity to the HSE, that not alone would their own private patients suffer, but that they wouldn't get adequately rewarded for it. And you could end up with the HSE then being completely out of capacity, because it seems to have been built in as a political assumption that they'd be able to use private ICU beds, and that might turn out not to be the case at all.
It's a possibility, yes. And it is, I think the thing we have to remember, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative way, that the private health sector in Ireland is run for profit. The public health sector is not run for profit. And there is a fundamental difference between trying to satisfy an entity which needs to make a profit and trying to build an entity that doesn't. And that is the complexity in the negotiation. It's as simple as that. Can we pay enough money to satisfy the private hospitals? There are some private hospitals and some private consultants who, no matter how much, and I respect that, that's fine, I have no problem with it, no matter how much you pay, don't like the public sector ethos and want to work with their own patients in their own way and want to be involved in their own specialties, and a lot of which are elective. If you've spent your entire life as a professional practitioner working on people's knees or hips or ankles, and you're brilliant at it and good at it, why would you want to give that up to, you know, come and work in a COVID ward? And I've no problem with any of that. But I heard Alan Kelly recently suggesting that what the state needs to do is buy a couple of these private hospitals. Mm. And I think there's a lot of merit in that, to be perfectly honest. If we can't rent the capacity, as it were, perhaps we need to buy the capacity.
Well, the argument that he was making was that the economic cost of buying them would be far lower than the lost tax revenues that you'd have to endure by going into some sort of restrictions, which is a reasonable point, and I thought was something that perhaps should have been sounded out a little bit more by the government. Sinead, there's also a point made in the Business Post today that ICU capacity is up by only 30 beds since virus arrived. And although, as Fergus points out, you can't just magic it up overnight, you need a team of very trained staff to do it. It's the sort of example that people will look at and just go, why didn't we do any better when we did have quiet times, when the hospitals weren't overflowing? We could have done some more preparation, and it seems as if a lot of that time people will think was lost anyway.
Yeah, and I think this really adds up to people who are listening to the WHO, Dr. Dave Navarro, saying, you know, lockdowns shouldn't be the first port of call for governments when they're trying to suppress the virus. They need to be used as ways to build that capacity, to kind of just pause time a little bit so the governments can build it up.
That
so
was the point, by the way. They weren't saying that lockdowns never work. They said they just should be a last resort, which unfortunately is the prospect we could be getting
to. That's what we're getting into now, because the ICU capacity. But I think part of that is people understanding, like what Fergus was saying there, it's not just about a physical bed, it's about the staff. And if we don't have the staff, because they have gone back to, so we had built up the surge capacity, but those doctors and nurses have gone back to what they were doing before COVID. So they we want them to be doing. We want people to be getting cancer treatments. We need people.
There's still a huge demand for accident and emergency. People still are getting cancer and heart attacks and strokes and nothing to do with COVID. And people still need access to hospital beds.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem, I think, is the summer as well, that I think there was a quiet time over the summer. We did think maybe we are out of the worst of that, and we didn't do well enough. Like 30 ICU beds, while they can't be magicked, it's not adequate. Like they should have done better.
No.
We will be talking to Anne O'Connor. Anne O'Connor is the Chief Operations Officer of the HSE, and we'll speak to her a little bit after 12 o'clock about some of the constraints that the health service will face and what might be the first bit that could have to be wound down if COVID occupies more resources than are needed. In the couple of minutes before I let you go, we had Roisin Shortall on News Talk Breakfast with Susan Keogh this morning, and she was making the observation that of the 9 people that were in government buildings yesterday, the 3 party leaders, the 3 other ministers and the 3 senior health figures who were discussing this idea of a nationwide shutdown, that there was no female perspective in the room. And I'm not sure whether many listeners would sympathise with that concern, Fergus, but do you think that perhaps decision making might suffer, or even just on a representative or optical level, if there aren't women in the room making that kind of call?
It's more than optical. One of the really bits of good news yesterday was Jacinda Ardern being re-elected as Prime Minister of New Zealand, and her management of the pandemic was attributed to her extraordinary success in that election. As a lifelong Labour Party member, I'm absolutely thrilled to see at least one Labour Party in the world getting 50% of the vote. And it was her leadership and her incredible capacity for empathy. And I don't want to say that that's a gender issue, but if you look at a lot of the countries in the world where, you know, I think Angela Merkel's approach to the whole thing has been extraordinarily effective as well. I think it's a crying shame, and but it's a reflection of the fact that there aren't enough women in senior positions, and there ought to be more.
And you're right, it's not just optical. There's a huge body of research done that decision making is bolstered by having more balance in rooms, and that's not just gender balance, but diversity balance as well. And we're obviously nowhere close to being even able to do that in our current government setup. But for me, there were a couple of glaring omissions from that, just by job, not by gender. The fact that Heather Humphreys wasn't there as the Minister for Social Protection, and the fact that Helen McEntee wasn't there as the Minister for Justice, given that we will be talking about enforcement and policing of this. So I think just not even by gender, there was a couple of people that should have been around the table, which by consequence would have brought gender and maybe that balance that we do require. I think it's also telling that we had the first Citizens' Assembly on women in leadership yesterday.
I also think Rosie Shortall should be around the table, and Mary Lou McDonald should be around the table. Every party leader in the Dáil needs to be involved in this process now, and it needs to be much wider than just...
True as that might be, that's probably Sinn Scéil Ella for another time. We're going to have to leave it there. Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the Journal.ie, and Fergus Findlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner. Thank you both very much for joining me on News Talk.